Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Robert Mugabe, Zimbabwean freedom fighter and former president of the country, dies at the age of 95, according to the Washington Post. Quote, Robert Mugabe, the Zimbabwean president who rose to power as a champion of anti-colonial struggle, but during 37 years of authoritarian rule, presided over the impoverishment and degradation of one of sub-Saharan Africa's most promising countries, died September 6th at a hospital in Singapore. He was 95 years old, end quote. That statement disgusts me. Doesn't surprise me, but it is incredibly disgusting because I know better. There is so much context. There is so much history. There is so much U.S. intervention and attempts of intervention directly and indirectly into the politics of Zimbabwe that for a newspaper such as the Washington Post to print a paragraph like this is beyond deplorable. Again, not surprising, but it's beyond deplorable. Because they talk about the fact of impoverishment and degradation in the country, but they don't talk about the United States contribution to the poverty and degradation. They don't talk about American sanctions over the country. They don't talk about the literacy rate in the country. And To go to this, we're going to go to my guest, Brother Sinclair Skinner. Sinclair, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Thank you, sir.
Let me read to you this paragraph that I just read from the Washington Post. Don't know if you saw it this morning. Robert Mugabe, the Zimbabwean president who rose to power as a champion of anti-colonial struggle, but during 37 years of authoritarian rule, presided over the impoverishment and degradation of one of sub-Saharan Africa's most promising countries. They don't mention the Lancaster House Agreement. They don't mention the fact that Britain agreed contractually with the Mugabe government to pay white Zimbabwean citizens for land that Mugabe was going to reclaim in return to indigenous Zimbabweans. And the fact that Britain reneged on the agreement, Jimmy Carter co-signed the agreement, President Ronald Reagan reneged on the agreement, and so President Mugabe just followed through on what the commitment was and told the white Zimbabweans, you have to get your money from Britain. And it was really that move, in my opinion, it was that move that turned President Robert Mugabe from an ally of the United States in the late 70s, early 80s, into an enemy. And it is my opinion, and I will then ask you for your thoughts, that the colonial power and former colonial powers could not afford to have an African freedom fighter claim success in resisting colonial rule. Your thoughts, sir?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There's so much of the history that's taken out of context. And at the end of the day, the way that Black people lived in Zimbabwe when it was Rhodesia was horrific. And after Mugabe rose to power through the revolution of the people, to create a country where you could talk about how many Black doctors, how many Black accountants, Black lawyers. Zimbabwe, in spite of everything you just said, all the wicked things that the West, with their billions of dollars, with their bombs and with all the things they have, they were not able to stop them from creating a country where Black people were able to become educated and have the highest literacy rate of all African countries. So you know, I tell people, you know, if you want to look at a leader that probably was the most powerful, successful, in spite of leader of the first of the 21st century, it has to be Robert Mugabe. He was able to transform from, you know, the days of Rhodesia through the Cold War, to the Berlin Wall falling down, to all the changes from South Africa being from apartheid to getting their freedom. He played a very instrumental role in all this development. And at the same time, we're educating people that ended up going all over the southern region to actually occupy key areas of professionals for most of the sub-Saharan Africa. So, you know, again, when we talk about these leaders, we have to keep them in context. You know, all that reneging, all those betrayals, he still was able to maintain a country where if you bring up Zimbabwe, you bring up their citizens, you ask anybody, what would it be the characteristics of a Zimbabwean? They would say they were smart and that they work hard. And that's a testament of that legacy that Robert Mugabe left. There's plenty of countries that wish when people brought up their citizens, they are thought of as being brilliant and hardworking. Well, that's what they did, in spite of the attacks on their sovereignty. And I think that's the biggest legacy I think we can take from Robert Mugabe is that he really believes in sovereignty, the self-determination of a nation. If you disagree with the policies, well, that's that country. That's their responsibility. The United States does not have the right to dictate to other countries what their policies are. That means that country is not really sovereign. That means it's a client state. Robert Mugabe made sure that his country had its own sovereignty and self-determination.
Let me throw out a couple of other points, and please, if I'm wrong, please set me straight. One is that for all of the people that want to herald the policies of former President Obama approved and continued sanctions against Zimbabwe. And people need to understand he should have known better. And not only should he have known better, he should have done better. But I understand he was a president of the United States, a functionary of the United States government. He maintained American foreign policy towards that country. That's point one. Point two, a lot of people, and rightfully so, want to hold former South African President Nelson Mandela, put him on the highest pedestal possible, which he well deserves. But there's a difference between President Mugabe and Nelson Mandela. Robert Mugabe retained control of the resources of his country. He retained control of the finances of his country. He retained control of the military of his country. President Nelson Mandela did not control the army. He did not control the resources of his country and really did not control the finances of his country. Those are two things I'd like for you to speak to.
I think the points you're making are true. I think the context, again, we got to kind of dig in because we can think these things and then we can't absolve ourselves. So when the Lancaster House Agreement was reneged on, we as citizens of the United States should have spoke out against it.
Correct.
He said, hey, this is wrong. We should have Jesse out there. We should have been out there. We should have been pressing our Congressional Black Caucus in 1990 and say, hey, there was an agreement made back in 1980. They allowed Ian Smith, the person who had been persecuting and killing him, they allowed him to retain a seat in Parliament. They allowed for the peaceful transition of government with probably the least amount of bloodshed without a major civil war. All those things took a lot of political savvy for President Mugabe to do because in other countries, once the colonizer left, they were able to foment a lot of insurrection that created bloodbath. Well, he was able to avoid much of that, and none of this being perfect. He was able to navigate all that and hold up his side of the agreement. And then in 1990, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, they basically were like, look, you can't turn to Russia. If you don't, you know, we're not going to give you the money. What are you going to do? Well, he still waited because the ANC was saying, look, if you cause trouble right now, we're trying to get our freedom from apartheid. can you just kind of hold back for a minute? Well, they held back 1994. The ANC was able to get their freedom with Nelson Mandela, and they still hadn't got the land. And what happened was that the war veterans that actually were the ones that didn't do it because they were going to get a pension, didn't do it because they were getting paid, because they believed that, look, this was a war about land. We are still do not have our land. So those folks started occupying in 2000. And Mugabe was so brilliant that at first he told the people, wait a minute, let's think about this. And the people said, we're not going to leave the land. Mugabe went to the parliament and said, look, we need to change the law to make, instead of making these land occupations illegal, we're going to change the law to make it legal. And he titled it the Fast Track Land Reform. So I don't know if you remember the Occupy movement in America.
Oh, absolutely.
Ultimately, these people got ejected out of these parks and stuff. Just imagine if they had the political savvy to literally change the law to make their occupations lawful. Well, that's what Mugabe did. He outsmarted the system and said, now this is a legal transaction. And those who refuse to submit to it, they're the ones breaking the law. So he did that. And then what happened was they started printing too much money. There's this thing of hyperinflation. In 2008, Mugabe and his people said, look, we're no longer going to have our own currency. We're going to come up with what they call a multi-currency regime. They said we're going to have a multi-currency regime where we're going to use the U.S. dollar, the rand, the pula, the kwacha. They had so you could go to Zimbabwe, and no matter what currency you had, you could do business there. They shocked the world. They mean, like, you're going to do away with your Zimbabwe dollar? They said, yes, that's what we're going to do. Why? Because we're not going to be beholden to a currency that really doesn't have the power that it needs to anyway. All I can say is that we as a people in America have to be more engaged with foreign policy. These things that are going on in Africa right now as we speak are wrong with the xenophobia and the policies that our government are doing. Just as much as you say Black Lives Matter in America, we need to be holding our politicians accountable for the policies in Africa.
Sinclair Skinner, hey, man, thank you very much for such coming on board such short notice. Greatly, greatly appreciate it.
You're the best. Thank you for keeping us aware.
Hey, man, thank you. And folks, let me say one more thing. It's one thing I think you'd find very interesting about former President Robert Mugabe. You never heard him speak. He would come to the United Nations and you'd never hear him speak. And the reason, I believe, that you'd never hear him speak is for the same reason that you did not hear Foreign Minister Javad Zarif speak on behalf of the Iranians, because they speak perfect English. And American media cannot afford to have people that are considered to be enemies speaking directly to the American people. That's why I was very surprised when Lester Holt from NBC did the piece with Zarif on NBC News. I was shocked because he does not need an interpreter. And when you sit down and listen to Zarif the same way as I have read and heard speeches by Mugabe, oh, man, they make perfect points. They make perfect sense. And they clearly articulate the positions of their countries, and they are able to refute the narrative, the foolish narrative. I almost said something that I'm not supposed to say on radio because I'm ready to spit nails right now. Because they are, A, incredibly intelligent people, and B, they speak very, very clear English. So they're able to speak for themselves without the need of an interpreter. And they are able not only to answer the questions that they're asked, but they're able to refute the narratives that are being promoted by this piece in the Post is just utter garbage. It is garbage. And that is not to say that Robert Mugabe was perfect. It is not to say that he was not without fault, but as Sinclair said very clearly, context and historical perspective are incredibly, incredibly important when you are trying to assess and evaluate the leader of a country. So I'll say this as I get out. Love former President Madiba. Love Nelson Mandela. Respect Nelson Mandela. But when you try to compare Nelson Mandela to Robert Mugabe, one man took control of his country and took control of his government. One man took control of his country and took control of his military. One man took control of his country and took control of his economy. And one man took control of his country and took control of his resources. That, folks, is sovereignty. And that is why the United States cannot tolerate, cannot afford, particularly a leader of an African country, to be heralded as someone who came from the bush, fought in the bush, armed struggle, threw the colonizer out, and was able to declare victory at all levels. And also, I think as Dr. Gerald Horn said on the last show, highest level of literacy on the continent. And I don't think Dr. Horn even talked about the AIDS epidemic and the AIDS rate in Zimbabwe and what Mugabe was able to do with the AIDS rate. And how quickly it dropped and did not spread through and decimate the country of Zimbabwe. Folks, I tell you, I could spend the next, I got what I got, 46 minutes, 43 minutes on this. But we got to move on with that. You're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. And again, thanks to Sinclair Skinner because he came up for us at the very last minute. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I am your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. It is Friday. That means it's panel time. And so with that, we go to my panel, and we're joined by a man with a PhD in political economy. He teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California, and is the author of the forthcoming book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Jack, as always, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
And we're also joined by a political analyst and commentator and editor of The Polemicist, Jim Kavanaugh. Jim, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Leon.
All right, gentlemen, we're still working on our third guest. We're having some technical issues, but we will move forward as we always do. U.S. economy adds just 130,000 jobs in August amid worries the trade war has sunk its teeth into hiring. The U.S. economy added a disappointing 130,000 jobs in August, according to the Labor Department today, heightening fears that Trump's trade war is starting to bite. The jobs report has taken on greater significance as concerns grow that the U.S. economy has entered a rough patch. Economists had predicted 160,000 jobs in August, but an anemic hiring in manufacturing, mining, truck driving, and retail, industries that are most directly affected by the trade war, helped to drag the gains down. Now, that 130,000 number isn't truly representative of the strength of the economy since hiring in August was boosted by the federal government adding part-time workers for the 2020 census. Without the addition of those temporary jobs, the new data reveal private sector companies added 96,000 jobs, the weakest in many months. Jack, what say you, since you just published the piece, what is the true unemployment rate in the U.S.?
Yes, well, it's a pretty poor job report. As you pointed out, it's significantly less than 130,000 because of all the census workers. And, you know, it takes about 130,000, 150,000 just to absorb new entrants every month into the labor force. So it's not even covering the hiring of new folks coming into the labor force unless you got a census job. But also in August, you get a boost because of people going back to school and teachers and so forth. So that's another not really private sector economy indicator.
Wait a minute. Let me jump in and clarify something because I did not know this until you just said it. Do you mean that teachers, because they don't work during the most of them don't work during the summer, that during the months from say May through September or whenever they're out for the summer, that they're not included in the labor force?
No. No, they're not. In fact, they can collect unemployment during the summer.
Oh, well, see, because I thought a lot of teachers have staggered their pay so that they get paychecks over the months that they're not in school.
No, they can stagger it, at least in California here, they can stagger it for, I think, 10 and a half or 11 months. But one month, they don't. You know, maybe that varies state by state. I don't know.
I think it varies state by state, but go ahead. That's fine.
Right.
Go ahead.
And then, you know, I'm not so sure that it's not overestimated because the government is picking up second and third part-time jobs. What I mean by that is the job stats count jobs. They don't count people without jobs who get a job. It's not as if someone got 130,000 people got hired. Well, a lot of those are new hires. But if you're counting second and third jobs and, you know, they say they make an adjustment for it, I don't think the adjustment is accurate enough anymore because there's such a large number of people taking on second, third jobs. There was a survey by Bankrate.com, I believe, that showed that 48% of all Americans have a second or third job. 48% have a second or third job now. That's a huge number. And if we're counting people getting second and third jobs, well, we're counting jobs increasing, but not necessarily people employed increasing. Although I'm not saying it's all second and third jobs, don't get me wrong. But, you know, the other big problem is this 3.7% unemployment rate you hear about. That's such a joke.
Mm-hmm.
That's called the U-3 unemployment rate for the government, the Labor Department. But it only counts full-time jobs, full-time employees. In other words, if we got about 60 million people who are part-time or temp or some other category, they're not in that 3.7 unemployment rate. When you add those people, they call them discouraged or missing or involuntary. When you add them, you get a double the unemployment rate, really well over 7%. And in my investigations, I think also the Labor Department is not picking up undocumented workers accurately or people working in the underground economy, which is about 15% of GDP equivalent now. Nor are they picking up people who go on Social Security disability because it's a better, longer-term unemployment. We've had a huge increase in that going on in recent years. When you add all of these categories and the fact that I believe the Labor Department is underestimating part-time and discouraged and missing, as they call them, and then you have this labor force participation rate, 5 percentage points less than it is today, which is about 6 or 7 million people less today than we used to have. Where did they go? You know, you're really up there at least 10%, maybe 12% unemployment when you add up all these wow. other categories.
Okay. Jim Kavanaugh, your thoughts, sir?
Well, yeah, I agree with everything that Jack just said. I think it's very important to recognize that they're playing around with these statistics now, as Jack indicated, in ways that make it very hard to understand what this means concretely for people's lives. And as he says, you have an enormous number of people taking two jobs and three jobs, because there's no such thing as a family wage anymore, and there's no such thing as there's very few secure jobs out there. You have the gig economy, which means people are dropping in and out of work every month, every couple of months, they're going to another job. And the participation rate, although it did increase apparently in this month to like 63% of, which is, you know, that leaves 37% unemployed. I mean, that's not a great thing, you know? So you have this low, historically low for a long time, labor participation rate. You're just ignoring the people who've completely given up looking for work or who go on public assistance, things like this. So reality, in terms of social reality, what it means, it's hard to figure out what this means. But everybody knows there hasn't been a great improvement in the lives of people. People are still mired in debt. They still can't pay their medical bills. They still can't pay their student loans. You know, they're living on credit cards. The rent's too damn high. So that's all still a reality that this really has nothing to do with. And it's very hard to determine politically, but also people have become used to that. People have swallowed a lot of, you know, they're kind of, there's a kind of new normal of this that people don't know how to get out of it and don't believe there is a way out of it. So I don't know politically where this is going to go. You know, this is not a picture of a socioeconomically healthy society for the masses of people.
Dr. Jack Rasmus, to pick up on Kavanaugh's point about social reality, and I think that is an incredibly important element in this discussion that you don't hear being analyzed or articulated with mainstream pundits and so on and so forth, because people are having a harder and harder time now retiring because pensions, for the most part, have gone away and have been replaced with 401k programs. To Kavanaugh's point, you've got overwhelming student debt. You have the suicide rate amongst white males in this country is reaching historic levels. That, to me, is a real indicator that the economy is not enabling those individuals with that sense of entitlement to realize what they were convinced they were entitled to. And so there are so many factors. The president told us as a candidate that he was going to bring these manufacturing jobs back. Well, the data is telling us that that's not happening. So the financiers are doing great, gangbusters. But the quality of life for people in this country is continually on the decline. Am I right or am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. Take the case of millennials, young folks, right? They're carrying the brunt of this lack of quality of life and jobs and so forth. 45% of them are working second jobs and third jobs. 45%, right? They're carrying—
Without benefits.
Yeah, without benefits, right.
Without benefits. Without Heaven forbid they get hit by a car or struck by lightning.
You know, people are using their credit cards. We got a boom in credit cards here that's driving the consumption, at least for most of the folks. And now they're going to get hit with an average $1,000 is being taken out of the average household as a result of these tariff price hikes coming this month. $1,000, right? Is that going to affect consumption, which is the only thing holding up the economy? Manufacturers in a recession. Construction is in a recession for over a year now. Business investment is flat or negative, right? These are all the real drivers of the economy. All we got is services going, and we got people using their credit cards and working second and third jobs to keep it going. That's the picture. And as you said about the old folks, they got no retirement. They're trying to live off of Social Security. The fastest sector of the growth of the labor force, people coming into it, are people over 70 years old. They're all coming back, taking these part-time jobs because they can't make ends meet. That's the situation for older Americans and the younger Americans I just described. 7 million people have turned back the keys on their automobiles because they can't afford to make the payment of it. $1.6 trillion in student debt, $1.2 trillion in auto debt, $1 trillion in credit card debt, $7 to $11 trillion in mortgage debt. We're up to our ears in debt, and we're not getting the income. And the generation in this thing about 3.1% wage increases is just totally phony. On my blog, I got an article explaining exactly how that's not true either.
And you didn't mention medical debt.
And rising premiums now that they've gutted for health insurance, that they, if you can afford it, that, as a result of gutting the ACA, the Obamacare, all the premiums are going up.
We got to get out for a break here. Let me quickly go to Jim and let him get in. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, everything Jack says is correct. And we all know this 3.2% increase in wages. Meanwhile, you have another economy, which is the economy of the asset holders and the financial asset holders, which is booming, where they're holding real estate, in huge trusts that aren't going into anybody. You have millions of empty homes that they're trying to get high rents from while people are homeless. Huge homeless problems in cities where you have the reappearance of diseases from people, typhus, and from people living in the street. So you've got, not only do you have this anemic, let's see if there's another 1% or 2% or 3% raise in the fake unemployment figures, but you've got to contrast this with what's going on in the other economy, which is the economy of the top 5, 5-10, but mainly the 0.1%, which is booming for them, and it's huge amounts of cash that they're holding on to, and it's being drained out of society. So, you know, that's the other aspect of this that has to be looked at. You know, this is not a picture of the real social economy.
And Jack, I know I said I was trying to get into the break, but Jim just made a point that I'd like for you to quickly hit on. You, a lot of times, talk about the real economy, and that, I think, is what Jim was just talking about, the real economy. So if you could just quickly, when people talk about the real economy, what is it that you actually mean?
Well, first of all, it has to be adjusted for inflation. That 3.1% wage increase, for example, is not adjusted for inflation. When you adjust it even for the low estimates of inflation, it's 1.5%. And that's not the whole picture either. That's the average for everybody in the workforce. In other words, if all the increases are skewed to the very top, software engineers and professionals and people with advanced degrees and managers and supervisors, well, then, you know, they're getting more than a 1.5%, and people in the middle and below are getting far less than 0.5%. So, you know, you got to think about this averaging. 60% of folks last year, 60% of the labor force got no wage increase at all, according to the bank rate survey. Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
How the hell do you get 3.1% for everybody if it's skewed to the top, if it's not adjusted for inflation, if it doesn't count the 60 million people who are on part-time temp and gig jobs? You know, when you look at it that way, everyone is flat or going backwards.
Got it. Folks, it's Friday. It's panel time. Dr. Wilmer Leon here. You were just hearing the voice of Dr. Jack Rasmus, PhD in political economy, teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California. You also are hearing the political analyst and commentator and editor of The Polemicist, Jim Kavanaugh. And this is the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. It's Friday, so it's panel time. We've got with us political economist and author of the forthcoming book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Jack, as always, thank you for staying with us. And we've got political analyst and commentator and editor of The Polemicist, Jim Kavanaugh. Jim, as always, thank you so much for staying with me. Wanted to hit this one real quick. In the Bahamas, after Hurricane Dorian, waiting for relief amid the bodies from Marsh Harbor, Bahamas, the port city of more than 6,000 was once home to quaint island businesses and wood frame homes. Then it was basically washed off the map by Hurricane Dorian, a Cat 5 hurricane, I think one of the highest, if not the highest, recorded to have come ashore. It's interesting to me, we are hearing more conversation about this, but still not enough conversation about this in the context of global warming. Jack Rasmus.
Yeah, well, it amazes me. I don't know what's the greater level of denialism by Trump, whether it's climate change, you know, or whether it's some other topic. But it's amazing that they don't recognize, well, they don't, they know. I don't think he's that stupid. You know, he's pretty thick, but I think they know what's going on here. But, you know, the oil and fossil fuel industries, as he said, Trump has said himself, you know, he's not going to sacrifice that. That's just worth too much. And, you know, everyone else is paying the price for this. And this is only the beginning, what's going on in the Bahamas here. We're going to see a lot more of that hitting the coasts this year, next year, and so forth. It's only going to get worse. And then, you know, the fires in the West and the drought in the West. And this is just the beginning. But, you know, money on the fossil fuel industry comes first.
Jim Kavanaugh, to Jack's point, one of the interesting things about this storm, we've been dealing with this thing for a week. It just won't go away. And they're saying now that after it passed the Carolinas and Virginia, heads kind of east out into the ocean. Now, Maine is going to be dealing with this thing, at least winds from this thing, on Sunday. This is one of the slowest moving hurricanes that I've seen in a very long time. But the Trump administration continues to chip away at energy standards. They just did away with the light bulb requirement about more energy efficient light bulbs. And they just don't seem, they're just stuck on stupid.
Yeah, these storms are becoming, this slow moving aspect of it is very important because it ends up dumping a lot of rain. That wasn't the issue in the Bahamas this time. They got, that went through and just wiped it out.
50 hours. That thing battered the Bahamas for 2 days.
Right, right. It stays in place and it dumps enormous amounts of rain and batters the and the wind batters the thing. So you have that aspect, and that's happened all over. So that's why you have a lot of flooding.
Right. 200 mile an hour winds.
Yeah, I know. It was incredible.
For 50 hours.
You can't survive that.
Jeez.
I saw charts of the, you know, how much of the island had been inundated by flood surges, and it was like 90% of the island had been underwater at some point or another. And so, you know, but all of these things, I mean, this is a general ecological consciousness and ecological project, but it's extremely difficult I don't know how we're going to deal with this, because it requires an international effort. It requires having resources and planning that's done in a kind of international way that's almost impossible to do. And I don't know how long it's going to take to wean ourselves off of fossil fuels. And even if we do, what's going to happen in the next 10 or 20 years with various ecological crises that have come about, droughts, floods? The floods in the Midwest this year were horrific. And this is going to happen again and again. And you know, I hope that the Green New Deal projects of people like Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez have—I don't really know the details on that well—but have a means of kind of addressing these things in a concrete way. But it's very difficult to do if you don't have a planned economy of some kind. If you don't have some kind of social planning in the economy that pre-plans for these things.
And let me say this and get out. To your point, it's also difficult when it's put in the context of polar bears stuck on ice floes that can't eat seals and glaciers that are melting. When you keep the narrative in that context, for as important as those things are, and for the signals that they send, that is incredibly important. But when you've got to put this in the context of Marsh Harbor and the fact that a whole island just damn near got washed off the map in a span of 2 days, because now you're talking people. And let me also I got to give a big shout out here. Hampton University offers free enrollment, room and board to displaced University of Bahamas students. The news was announced by Hampton President Dr. William Harvey. According to the Williamsburg Yorktown Daily, Dr. Harvey said he brokered the deal between him and University of Bahamas President Rodney Smith, a former Hampton University vice president. And as a Hamptonian, I am very proud of my institution, very proud of my president, even though y'all know I got serious problems with him. On this one, he's spot on. Congratulations and thank you, Dr. Harvey, for doing something right. Let's move on to Boris Johnson and Brexit. Takes a wrecking ball to the government and gets hit with it himself. Boris Johnson's brother, Joe Johnson, quit the UK government because he did not want to engage in an ongoing family squabble. He says family loyalty and national interest are more important to Joe Johnson than it is Brexit. He had championed against Brexit, a position that put him at odds with his older brother, Prime Minister Boris Johnson. And also, he suffered three defeats back to back. His first three votes he lost. I think he's the first prime minister in the history of the country to suffer that problem. And let me go back to Jim Kavanaugh. Your thoughts on Brexit and what this means for Boris Johnson?
Well, this is not just a problem for Boris Johnson. This is a problem for the entire British political class. And I think it's basically a problem of whether they go, who wants to honor the Brexit referendum or not. And most British politicians do not. And they've got themselves in a trap over this. And Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn has got himself in a trap over this. The Labour Party is putting itself in the incoherent position of saying, oh, we want to negotiate a different deal, which they're not going to get a better deal. And then if we negotiate a different deal, we want to put that to the voters and argue against it, argue to remain, not to leave.
One reason that they're not going to get a better deal is because there is no other deal on the table.
Exactly. Well, there's no deal on the table. That's right. Johnson doesn't have another deal, and it's going to be hard to find one. And nobody wants to let them out without punishing them very seriously. The EU wants to make sure that anybody that leaves gets punished seriously, okay? They don't want anybody to leave. But you have this internal situation in Britain where everybody said, we will abide by the referendum, and yet nobody, very few people actually want to do it. And this is the great political problem. The Labour Party wanted a new election. Boris Johnson says, let's have a new election. The Labour Party doesn't really want it if it's going to be perceived as an election on Brexit, because Johnson might win on that. That's what's really going on here. So, and he may or may not. It's a big risk for everybody here in the situation. But it's been a mess because for 3 years they've been trying to avoid it, and they're still trying to avoid it. And I wouldn't put money that October 31st they'll leave. I think they're going to get another extension. They're going to demand another extension. I don't know. It's up to but it's not only up to the British Parliament. If Brussels doesn't want to give them any more time, they're gone.
Dr. Jack Rasmus.
Yeah, well, as was said, they're not going to get a better deal. You know, the European Union can't give them a better deal. It's in a severe economic crisis. It's going into another recession. Its main engine, Germany, is already probably in recession or damn close. Italy is in recession. It can't afford to give a deal to Britain to leave that isn't onerous. Because if it does, they're giving a signal to the rest of the recalcitrant countries and economies that might want to leave too. So it's better for the UK to have a difficult time if it wants to leave than it is to make an easy way out. Now, what you got in Britain is a split in the ruling class, and it's reflected in the institutions. You know, some wanted to leave. They think that they can return to a kind of British Commonwealth and get a better economic boost from that. Or some of them naively think they're going to get a special relationship deal with the United States, which is nonsense. Or that they could have a Norway-like relationship, which they're not going to get from the EU. But the fact is, they're going to lose a lot of money. One wing of the ruling class is going to lose a lot of money with a hard Brexit or any kind of Brexit. Collapse the currency, which is already beginning, will, you know, intensify, and that means a loss of wealth for wealth holders and asset holders. Stock market will decline sharply. The pound will decline. Profits from sales on the continent will decline because you have tariffs, and the price of imports into Britain from the continent will go up. So they know it's an economic disaster if they leave. And I believe that one wing of the ruling elite there is not going to let it leave and wait until it's an opportune time to have another referendum. Another wing, the Bojo wing there, wants to leave, but it's a reflection of this intensifying crisis going on at the political level. And you see it not just in Britain, right? You see it in Italy. You see it in the U.S. with Trump, right? You see it other places around the world. The shift to the right is all because of a vacuum of lack of opposition. You know, social democratic parties have collapsed everywhere or been co-opted. Unions have been decimated everywhere. People have no way to act organizationally except maybe just a referendum here, if they're allowed a referendum. Mm-hmm. So in this vacuum, this more aggressive right wing of, I believe, the capitalist class has has entered onto the stage, and it's engineering a change in the institutions and an undermining of democracy so it can push through its policies.
The next issue, Pentagon diverts $3.6 billion in military funds to build 175 miles of Trump's border wall. Jim Kavanaugh, I know that candidate Trump told me that he was going to build this wall and he was going to get Mexico to pay for it. Now, he told me that. I don't know if he told you that, but I know he told me that. Now, the Pentagon is defunding Hurricane Maria recovery projects at military installations in Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, to pay for Trump's border barrier. He's also impacting CONUS, or Continental United States, sites in New Mexico, in Texas. Jim Kavanaugh, talk to me.
It's really kind of a ridiculous thing on the face of it. As you say, you know, it just undermines this whole notion that Mexico's going to pay for the wall. You know, on the one hand, I'm not sad to see money being taken from the Pentagon to be spent on almost anything else. But on the other hand, he's going to take it from as much as possible from the things that are, of all the things the Pentagon does the best, like the Hurricane Maria. And he's going to build something which is a boondoggle. And there's another issue, which is, of course, the constitutional issue of whether the president can reassign these funds, which impacts the power of the purse, the constitutional authority of Congress. Now, what you are seeing here, which is interesting and people aren't talking too much about, is the emergency authorities of the president and the fact that we are under 20 emergency proclamations. And you've seen articles about this in the Times and the major media in the past couple of weeks. Oh, well, legally, that authority really is there because of all of these states of emergency we're under, but nobody ever thought they'd be used that it would be used that way. And Trump might get away with it legally and constitutionally, which people should look at and say, we have to look at this fact that we've passed these emergency states of emergency that give executive authorities for the president to use if he or she wants to, and someone like Trump is going to come along and use it.
Jim, to your point, this is real presidential brinksmanship, in my humble opinion. He's putting the Democrats in a very, very bad spot, at least in particularly, primarily because they don't have the guts to really push back as they need to. And Jack, let me also throw in here, instead of taking $3.6 billion from the military and building this foolish, ridiculous wall, what if he had taken $3.6 billion, declared a state of emergency, and said, we're rebuilding the water system in Flint. We're rebuilding the water system in New Jersey. And we're going to give $1 billion divided up amongst the school systems in this country to pay teachers more.
Well, whichever he might do, it's an act of usurpation. It's clear a constitutional crisis is brewing, and you're seeing the beginning of it. He's usurping legislative powers under the Constitution, where not only
the power of the purse,
and where it's going to be spent. Mm-hmm. You know, the worst up until now was under Nixon, where he impounded the money, but he didn't divert it. He's diverting it. He's a usurper. And then let's add the usurpation to this emergency power, in other words, rule by dictate, right? That's all that really is, declare emergency power, and like as if there was some, world war or something, and he's got all these precedents now of doing this, and he's just deepening the opportunity to rule by executive decree when he does that. And then, of course, he's also a tyrant, because tyrant means you're above the law. And he said many times he'll just pardon himself if he was ever convicted and pardon his buddies and so forth. So we got a real problem here with the executive branch under this guy. And it's all anti-democracy across the board.
But you know what, Jack? You know what, Jack and Jim? For as big of a problem as he is presenting, to me, the bigger problem is the Democrats are punks. And they're not standing up to the bully. And what you got to do when a bully's on the playground, you got to walk up to him and you got to punch him in the mug. That's how you deal with bullies. And the Democrats, in my humble opinion, are not doing their jobs. Gentlemen, Jim Kavanaugh, thank you so much. Dr. Jack Rasmus, as always, thank you. Hey, folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here next week on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.